Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power, the Champions League. We love it as much as Neymar loves himself.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
I'm prepared to do anything I can to play my country again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
I was, it wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Now you're welcome back. Half time in the Champions League this evening. Man City 1-0 up on the night against PSG. Mahrez with the goal on 11 minutes. So you would think, barring disaster in the second half, that's Man City home and hosed and through to a Champions League final for the first time. We'll talk to Pat Nevin a bit later on about the weekend's football, not least events at Old Trafford. But first up, we wanted to pay tribute to this man.
Free kick to the Republic of Ireland. Here's Dennis Irwin to take it. Comes straight out to McLaughlin! It's there! Alan McLaughlin has done it! He could not believe it! He looked for the linesman's flag, but Windsor Park is stunned into silence. Alan McLaughlin has struck gold for Ireland. His very first goal for the Republic of Ireland, headed out by Taggart. He sees the responsibility, and the man from Portsmouth proves himself another masterstroke as a substitution. Taggart's clearance, but this is a classy finish, an unbelievable finish. The man who first came to prominence during the World Cup in Italy may well have secured the Republic's passage to the next one. Splendid strike, no chance right. 77 minutes gone, and it's one apiece, and we're back in business.
Yeah, Alan McLaughlin, desperately sad news reaching us this evening, and the footballing world has come out to pay tribute to Alan McLaughlin, just 54 years of age, far too young to have passed away. Was diagnosed with cancer back in 2012, and I'm sure had many difficult days and evenings with it. Fought very bravely, did lots of commentaries for us here on Off the Ball on Sunday afternoon. 42 Republic of Ireland caps, of course, between 1990 and 99. Scored that goal at Windsor Park. Must be one of the most important Irish goals in a very elite company, certainly. And terribly sad news this evening. The FAI president, Jerry McEnany, said Alan will always be remembered for that goal in Belfast 28 years ago, a goal that brought the entire country to its feet. And Jonathan Hill, the FAI chief executive, said this is most tragic news. Our thoughts are now with Alan's wife, Debbie, and his two daughters and his extended family. I spoke with Alan before we honoured him at the Luxembourg game in March, and I know how proud he was of his 42 appearances in the Ireland jersey. Very happy to say Ray Houghton has taken the time to join us. Evening, Ray.
Good evening to you.
Desperately sad, 54, just so young to go, and he had a really tough battle, I'm sure.
Yeah, he certainly did. I didn't know it was as bad as it was. I mean, I did see on social media about 2-3 weeks ago that he was thanking a lot of the fans who came out and said, you know, I hope you get through this. So I didn't know how bad it was. And normally, as you just said there, like Alan, we would have been at like a lot of games. And that's where normally I would have met him. You know, before matches, we'd sit down, we'd talk about the game we were going to watch, the individuals that we were looking forward to watching, previous encounters between the two of us in games that we played in, and obviously playing for Ireland as well. So we used to have a really good chat. He was a fantastic lad, real football man, knew his stuff. And as you said, you know, it's a terribly sad day for everyone connected with Irish football. And who knew Alan, you know, and as you said, his wife and his two daughters. I just can't think what they're going through at the moment. Just, it's absolutely devastating.
Yeah, horrific, horrific. I think he kept his battle with cancer pretty private. I do remember the initial diagnosis. And like you, I thought he'd been okay, but then Reportedly in 2019 he was told it had returned and it had spread and it had become very serious, and I think that was part of the rationale behind the tribute that was paid to him at the Luxembourg a while back. So I mean, it's amazing, you obviously were meeting him at games. It wasn't something he was necessarily talking about at length, obviously.
No, I mean, I think he had part of his kidney removed, his kidney removed, didn't he, in 2012 or thereabouts, you know, when he had his first bout. I think he had a tumour, wasn't it, on his kidney, and I think that had to be removed. And at the time I remember ringing him up and speaking to him about it, and he made very light of it. You know, I think he was even in the hospital when I spoke to him. And then when I seen him afterwards, you know, he'd sort of got back on his feet and he was looking well, and he was at matches. And you're quite right. You know, he's a very private individual. You know, he wouldn't tell you about any of his ailments. He just got on with things. I know he was working at Swindon with the youth team. I know he thoroughly enjoyed that side of it. You know, he's a real football man. You know, most of his career was spent at Portsmouth. Played against them, you know, way back when, I think in the semi-finals of the FA Cup. He was just a really, you know, terrific fellow. And he was a manager's dream, you know, because he got 42 caps for Ireland, or thereabouts, or in that region.
Yeah.
And I know he got a couple of goals. I didn't realise that was his first goal, you know, what you just said there. And the one against Northern Ireland. What a goal to get as well. You know, it was absolutely phenomenal. Because he came on for me that night. And obviously, me personally, when coming off, you're obviously disappointed to come off. But I couldn't have been more delighted for Alan, you know, because he was such a lovely lad. You know, he never caused any trouble. You know, he was a manager's dream because he trained hard, he worked hard. Whenever he was asked to come on and play or start a match, he was always ready and willing to do so. He was just a, you know, super trainer, super individual, had a lot of time for Alan. And I couldn't have been more happier when he scored out, for obvious reasons. You know, we got through to the World Cup in 94. But for him as an individual, you know, when you have to be that patient and you're not always in the starting 11, it's not easy to keep coming over to represent your country when you know you're not going to be in the starting 11. But Alan done that without a bother, and he just got on with it as best as he could. And, you know, as he says, he was brilliant for Jack that way. Wouldn't cause any problems, just got on with it.
Mm. Stay with us, Ray. Andy Townsend on the line. Hi, Andy.
Hiya, pal. How you doing? Okay.
Yeah, very well. Desperately sad news for you and your teammates, not to mention, obviously, his wife, Debbie, and his two daughters. Just a desperately sad loss, 54 years of age.
Yeah, unbelievably sad. I just echo everything that Ray's has said there about him. He's such a lovely guy. I spoke to him about four and a half weeks ago, something like that. And yes, he knew, obviously, he faced a big challenge, but he was, you know, prepared to front it and face it and battle it as best he could. And it's just such a shame, obviously such a great shame, that getting the news today. And obviously deepest sympathies and heartfelt condolences to Debbie and all of our family. But as Ray said, a great guy, a great team guy. He had a lovely, sharp sense of humour. And he played in the same sort of fashion. He had a very canny game, Alan, and he was a very useful and a very, very good part of our squad and our team. And nothing showed that better than what he did that night up in Windsor Park, you know.
And Ray was just making the point as well. He was a brilliant professional, you know, had to bide his time and wait, but was ready to be called upon and always showed up and earned those 42 caps.
Well, 100%. I mean, if you know, Alan would be, with respect, Alan would be a first name on the team sheet in the current setup. It's just that he was, you know, there was a lot of, in our era, mine and Ray's era, there was a lot of good players around, and Jack kind of had very, very much was the type of boss that once he had a team in his mind, he kind of, when it was available, he tended to stick with what he knew. And it's never easy being, you know, making sure that you're there, making sure that you're ready, turning up every time, and yet not always starting matches. But Al was the sort of guy that understood that, got on with that, and then when he was called upon, he was always ready. He was always ready to come on and try and make the difference. And again, as I say, you know, he did it so amazingly for us that night to get us to the 94 World Cup. Without him, without that goal, we wouldn't have got there, simple as that.
Mm. He obviously, as you said, good sense of humour as well. Ray, I was reading a quote from him. He was talking about USA 94 and he was saying he'd been talking to his wife and she'd been missing him because he was away from home. But he was back at the hotel. He'd been invited out for a drink by Larry Mullen of U2. And they were asking him, you know, what was he doing? And they were missing him. And he said, I told her I was tired and I was having a very quiet night in. And then I scurried out for pints with Larry Mullen, who had sent the limo to collect me. So he obviously had a good time as well and enjoyed himself as well.
I think we were all in we had two limousines, to be brutally honest with you. And I think a lot of the wives had either gone home or gone back to Orlando, where we were based. And I think we had a night out in New York, and Larry took us out and showed us round. But the end of the story was we ended up in the McDonald's eating fast food because I think we'd had enough, you know, with the games and everything else that was coming up. I think about 3 o'clock in the morning, we were sitting on the limousine eating McDonald's, which in itself was absolutely hilarious. But he had a great sense of humour, as Andy said there. You know, Jack had a tight-knit group. You know, we didn't have an awful lot of players to choose from. Not that that bothered Jack. He was very happy to have a small number. But what he wanted was that everyone he is liked to be in each other's company. Mm. And I can't speak highly enough about that. We all went out as a group, as we just indicated there about the Larry Mullen story, which was absolutely true. We went out as a group. You know, we looked after each other. And regardless who's in that starting 11, we wished everyone the very best. And if you came off and someone went on in your place, you were wishing them to go out there and do exceptionally well. That's why it was quite unique. And that's why we had such a great understanding. And we, you know, we were running through, the old adage about running through a brick wall for your teammates. That was us. That was Alan. Alan was certainly that type of individual. Mm. And as I say, after he's, you know, he's footballer, you know, when we met him, Andy will tell you when you met him, you know, he loved talking about football. He was so passionate about it. He was a real football man.
Andy, you must have seen him at games doing media work down the years recently as well.
Yeah, I've seen him a lot. Obviously, a lot of the South Coast games, Alan was often covering them. I used to see him, obviously, a fair bit at Southampton and down at Bournemouth. I've seen him a lot. And I know that, obviously, he'd been working at Swindon over the last few years, working with their academy. I'd seen Alan a lot. And you know, as Ray will tell you, we kind of all knew that he was he hadn't been well, and that he'd battled this obviously in various forms for a few years now. But when I spoke to him 4 or 5 weeks ago, as I said, I wasn't totally aware just how poorly he was, bless him. And you know, he was great. He spoke very honestly, courageously, and openly, and very typical of him. You know, he still had time for a little laugh and a joke. But he knew himself that he faced an almighty challenge to try and get over this. Yeah. And it's so sad that on this occasion he was unable to do it. But a great man, a great lad, and just a lovely unaffected guy to be around you and to be part of the team. He really was a smashing guy, and he'll be very, very sadly missed.
I think people can hear the sincerity of both your tributes. Andy, your team, this team, you, Ray, I think Paddy Bonner's going to join us in a couple of minutes as well. There is a real bond there, and it probably stems from the success and what, you know, Jack created and Daft Nights Out with Larry Mullen. But those must be the things when you hear news like that today that you probably remember with a bit of a smile. There is a lovely bond with your group, it seems.
There's a very unique bond. I never experienced it. I experienced some great dressing rooms, you know, with the teams that I played for, but I never experienced one like ours we had in that period. It was, as Ray said, it was just such a pleasure to be part of it. And that's why news like we've all received today hurts everybody, because, you know, it doesn't seem like, even though it's 30 years ago and some of those amazing occasions that we were part of, they seem like 5 minutes ago, and it seems like 5 minutes ago that myself and Ray and Al and everybody else were enjoying each other's company and jumping in those limos to
to go and see Larry. You know, in New York, it does. It just, it's gone so fast, the time. It's flashed past. And thankfully, you know, the memories will never be erased. They'll always be there. And it's just a, it's been a very, very sad day today. I genuinely wasn't expecting the news that that I received today. As I said, I knew Alan was facing a big challenge, but I wasn't expecting the news, and I'm really, really saddened by it. But lovely guy, great guy.
You know, 1993 November, when we played against Northern Ireland, probably typified what we were like as a group. And that was, we were going into the Lions then. This was fearsome. You know, I've got to say, going into that game, I remember going to training when the RUC was at the front of the bus, at the back of the bus. We had some officers on the coach as well. Same when we went to the game, but we stuck together and we knew it was going to be tough out there. And sometimes you get, you know, someone who's going to turn out to be a hero on the night that you probably didn't think so before a ball was kicked. Alan was that man that night, and he will be forever remembered by all the Irish fans for what he did over his career with Ireland and that goal that night. But more importantly, you go to every club that Alan played for, you will not hear one bad word said about him. He was such a nice guy. He was a football man, a true gent, and he's going to be sadly missed, as Andy said.
It's a lovely tribute, Ray. I guess it says a bit about him that he stood up on that night, you know, in that atmosphere and that cauldron, and delivered his first goal at that moment. That there's a bit of substance there.
No, absolutely. And of course, you know, as legend has it, that night, Jack asked Cass to get warmed up, to get ready to go on, and Cass had left his shirt in the dressing room, typical Cass. So he then turned to Alan immediately and said, "Al, you get going." You know, Alan, ready to go, jumped straight on, and you know, within, I can't remember how long it was after coming on, Al, but he got himself a great strike with his left peg, and it got us back in the game. And it felt like the sort of night where it wasn't going to happen for us. We needed something like that. And as Razor says, you know, that it's not always the obvious guys that maybe make the difference on those occasions. And certainly Alan stepped up and played such a key part that night. It's not always easy coming on as a sub to get up to speed. We've all done it, and it's not easy to come on and always have an effect. And again, Alan, when he came on that night, he was absolutely ready for it, and couldn't have had a bigger effect, could not possibly have had more to say in a game than he did on that night. So, it's amazing.
The goal itself technically was brilliant, wasn't it? I mean, George Hamilton, George was doing the commentary there when he said about, you know, Taggart headed the ball out. He chested it down. It was on his left side. He was more renowned to being a right-footed player, but he took that responsibility of taking the shot on, and it flew past the goalkeeper. And then it gave us hope. It gave us belief that we were going to go on and qualify. And, you know, we had a good night that night as well when we got back to Dublin, and certainly the hero was Alan and deservedly so.
Yeah. I'm sure he'd have got an earful from everybody as well if he had skied that one high with his left foot. You know, it was a kind of a brave effort to take on.
Well, he probably saved Tony Cascarino's career that night, didn't he? Because I think if we'd have lost that game, I think Jack would never have forgiven Cass for not having his shirt when he should have done, when he left it in the changing room at half-time. So I'm sure Cass will be having a special thought for Alan today, I'm sure.
Yeah. Look, it's very sad. Thank you both for coming on. He's very warmly remembered over here. You can imagine the text coming in and people remembering where they were that night and wishing his family all the best. So, Ray, thank you for coming on. Appreciate it, Ray Houghton.
Thank you.
Andy Townsend, much obliged, Andy. Thanks for coming on.
No problem. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thanks, fellas. The sad news again this evening, if you hadn't heard, Alan McLaughlin passed away aged 54. Latest in the Champions League, 58 minutes in the clock. Man City 1-0 up against PSG, 3-1 on aggregate. Mahrez with the goal in 11 minutes. We'll take a very short break. Paddy Bonner is going to join us for just a couple of minutes. He also wanted to come on and pay tribute to Alan McLaughlin. And then Pat Nevin will join us on a rather bizarre weekend as well at Old Trafford.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Let's be honest. If you were Declan Rice or Jack Grealish, you'd choose England too.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Welcome back. 62 minutes on the clock in Manchester. 1-0 to City against PSG. Mahrez with the goal. 3-1 on aggregate. So it looks very much like Man City through to the Champions League final. We had Ray Houghton and Andy Townsend with us if you're just tuning in and missed the lads paying tribute to Alan McLaughlin, who passed away at the far too young age of 54, won 42 Republic of Ireland caps between 1990 and 99. Of course, scored that goal at Windsor Park in 1993, one of the great and most important goals in Irish football in history, and very fondly remembered, and had a really tough battle with cancer over a number of years. Paddy Bonner is with us. Evening, Paddy.
Evening, Joe. Yeah, sad news for everybody concerned. Yeah.
I think the last time we spoke on the show actually might have been the passing of Jack. So, look, that was very sad in its own way. 54 is sadder again in many ways, and family left behind.
Yeah, and, you know, Alan was one of these unassuming type of guys in the squad, but what a great personality, too, to be around. And sitting, you know, he was, in a, you know, these people that's in the squad, you know, it's not just about a team that plays every week and so on. The people that's in around the squad also makes the whole thing happen, you know. And Alan, of course, we know the impact he had when he came on in Northern Ireland. It was huge impact, and what a great goal it was. But I just, you know, if you talk to any of them, talk to the staff, I was talking to McBurn today, and I'll give Charlie O'Leary a ring tomorrow. But he remember Alan fondly because he was never any trouble. He was always a guy that was happy to be there. Happy to be there for the cause. Happy to be there to lend himself to the group of players, and, you know, in training and all that. He went about his job so professionally and all that. But just a nice person, also, you know, you can sit down and have a conversation with him. A very intelligent man, also. And I love being in his company. I haven't seen him for quite a while. I spoke to him after his first bout of cancer, and I didn't realise he was so bad. But when the news came true today, I was pretty shocked and saddened, I must admit. And, you know, for a family and for a young age, and it's a devastating blow to everybody.
Yeah, it seems he kept it relatively quiet. Andy Townsend was on just before you, Paddy, and he was saying he spoke to him maybe 4 weeks ago, and even he wasn't fully aware of just how serious things were at that stage. So maybe he elected to keep it quiet. You said something there which Ray Houghton echoed, and Ray said he was a manager's dream. Just you're priceless, those people who come in and have their act together and work hard and bide their time often on the substitute bench and keep on showing up and really earn their 42 caps. And, you know, to have players like that in your squad and in your world is absolutely invaluable and says a lot about them, I suspect.
Yeah, there was a number of them, you know. Like, so I remember John Byrne didn't play that often, but it was always there. Alan Kelly, of course, later on, of course, had a bit of a time, but always there. You know, and those type of people. Bernie Slaven came in, did the same for a while, and Alan was one. And I was so happy for Alan when he made that huge impact. You know, for a guy who was always the backup kind of guy, to be able to come off a bench in such an important game down Northern Ireland and get almost become famous overnight for that goal, you know, and that doesn't happen to too many people too often. And for it to happen to such a good guy like him, I think it was brilliant. But you're right, you know, you need those players. You know, you can't have players in a squad that probably, yes, they all want to play, don't get me wrong, they all want to play, but they create a problem for the manager, they create problems if they're not playing. Those are the players that make life difficult for a manager. But if they're there and they're happy to be there, but they're also able and ready to make an impact when they do come on, they're the kind of guys that you want around the place. And Alan typifies that so well over the years. So yeah, listen, yes, and you know, I know he went on to do coaching. He was coaching down in Portsmouth and Swindon and different things. So he was still, you know, making an impact after he retired. And again, you could see him being a really good coach and being a bit of a father figure to some of the young boys too, no doubt.
It's an underrated thing to have said about any of us, isn't it, that you've said and Ray said and Andy said that he was just a really, really good man, good person?
Yeah, you know, if we went out for a night, Alan would be there. He would be the quiet one, but he joined in and he had his laughs and he had his stories and so on. And, you know, I remember him telling me lots of stories about himself and Lou McCarry when when they were down at Swindon too, and that he used to drive Lou McCarry to certain games and different things, you know, which was quite incredible. So he had an impact, and listen, he played in England, and whatever club he went to, I'm sure the same story that we're telling here about his times with Ireland would have been exactly the same. How do you would describe Alan?
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's very sad, and you could hear it with Ray and Andy as well. There's such a bond with your team, and they were remarking on that too. You know, such a tight knit group. Andy was saying he's been in lots of good dressing rooms, but he's never experienced a bond like your bunch in the late 80s, 90s.
Absolutely, you know, and everybody was desperate to turn up. You know, that was it. Listen, success helps, and being under a manager like Jack Charlton helps. But I think it was the atmosphere that was in around the hotel and around the team. Going into town, the whole group of us having a cup of coffee and a little cafe off Grafton Street, and that type of stuff. You just can't, you know, going to the racing with Jack, going play pigeon shooting, heading down to the Newmarket Hotel, having times together, having a cup of coffee, down in Malahide, all of those type of things. That's part and parcel of the whole thing too. It's not just about what happens out on the pitch. And these guys, like Alan, and as I said, we were all part of it. And that was the other great thing about it. I don't think any of us felt that we were superior to anybody else, even though we may have played more games and so on. It really was a squad thing. Very much like a club environment touring around the place. And I've said that many, many times in interviews, and that's what it was like. You have to have a group to get on well together. We don't see each other that much, you know, and now, of course, we won't see Alan ever more, but, you know, when we did get together as a group, we enjoyed our company, and we had a few pints, a few drinks, a few stories, and all of that, and unfortunately, for Alan, that has come to an end now, but it's the family too, you know, they'll miss him so much, I know that, and his close friends that he has around about him, you know, not too young for that to happen in a young man.
It is 54. Hopefully it's the last time or we're having a conversation like this for a long time. Paddy, thanks so much for coming on and paying tribute.
Pleasure.
Much appreciated. Cheers. Paddy Bonner there. Paying tribute to Alan McLaughlin, passed away at the age of 54. Condolences again to his family in particular. Just dreadful time. And he was a very valued member of the team here at times. Did many a commentary on Sundays with Dave McIntyre on earlier on, who talked about spending mornings passing the time with him until kick-off in our commentary games on Sundays. So he was always a gent to deal with here. So again, condolences to all concerned. That's Alan McLaughlin, who has passed away at the age of 54. We'll take a short break, and then we weren't on yesterday given the bank holiday. We will look back on a rather odd weekend of football and non-football as well with Pat Nevin next.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Only the cream of the crop pick up Champions League medals. Jonathan Greening's got one.
Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Okay, so it's all going off over in Manchester. Riyad Mahrez put them 1-0 up on 11 minutes. 63 minutes, Riyad Mahrez scored his second goal. That was about 7 minutes ago. So it's 2-0 Man City. 4-1 on aggregate there. Through to the Champions League final. Huge achievement for them. Angel Di Maria has been sent off. Looks like a straight red. And I'm seeing Zinchenko is not happy either over something. He's been given a yellow. So certainly some handbags. Pat Nevin is with us evening. How you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm all right. I suspect you know what's going on. You're in a hotel in London, are you?
Yeah, I'm about 30 yards that way, Stamford Bridge.
Oh, nice.
So I'm in the hotel. It's actually right beside Stamford Bridge itself. So I'm already in the ground, ready for tomorrow's game against Real Madrid. Big build-up for this one, obviously, in West London. Everyone's pretty excited about it. And kind of hope the actual game goes ahead. That would be nice.
Well, I mean, we've a lot to talk about, don't we? I presume you have been watching Man City PSG this evening. What would you say about the first 71 minutes of this game?
Yeah, they're really impressive, Man City. I mean, the work rate's been fantastic tonight. Playing a game where they're breaking brilliantly. I mean, looking absolutely phenomenal on the break. PSG are trying to throw as much as possible at them, but A, they're defending well, throwing their bodies in front of the ball, just as they did in the first game. They've had a luck a couple of times as well. You know, there was certainly, they hit the bar, I think it was Marquinhos, hit the crossbar, and certainly Di Maria should have scored. He had an opportunity to score, which would have made it interesting. But over the piece, really impressed by Manchester City. We know that they can play a bit, but Mahrez tonight has been super. De Bruyne, he's having so much space to run into, and you can't give that to De Bruyne. So, no, they look pretty special tonight. But the thing that impressed me more than anything else, you know, Fernandinho in the centre of that midfield, everybody is working so hard. Man City of the past might have kind of cruised and want to win it beautifully. Right, get the grit and the hard work in as well as the beautiful football. And that's what it takes to win the Champions League. And they have got a great chance now because, as we know, they're definitely through that.
Yeah. So, well, a lot to talk about. The weekend that was, the game that wasn't at Old Trafford, the protest started. We had Andy Mitten on OTBAM, our morning show here, and he was saying, you know, fans show up. They say, they're, you know, I'm going, are you going? Yeah, I'm going. You don't quite know how many will show up. Turns out, big enough crowd. You certainly don't expect to get into the stadium. You get in there, what do you do? Well, I'm going to climb the goal because it looks like a fun thing to do. I'm going to toss a flare towards Graeme Souness because I don't know what else to do. One lad brought a football. So, you know, it's just a surreal kind of situation. It's hard to know where it goes from here. Are you anticipating now we see more protests? Is going to become a commonplace thing? Does it die away over the summer? They certainly won't get into the stadiums again. Security will be beefed up.
Well, that shouldn't be the case anyway, but, you know, massive numbers, if they turn up at some of the games, there is the possibility of that. And I mean, I listened to Andy Mitten speaking a few times in various places, and first of all, how well that he speaks, brilliantly he speaks with passion and understanding of the situation, as a lot of the Manchester United fans do. But the question you're asking is what happens next. I was actually at the Newcastle versus Arsenal game, and we were handing over to, obviously, the big one. But there was no big one to hand over to. I was thrown into to talking about it. And when you're looking at it like that, I mean, first and foremost, you say right at the start, I understand exactly what Man United fans are feeling. I sympathise with what they're feeling. In fact, I'm on their side, absolutely on their side. I'd love to see the Glazers out here, you know, because they just don't have the feeling for football and what it should be, certainly in England, but in a club like Manchester United. That said, is it taking it slightly too far to get the game stopped? If there was any violence, and there was only limited violence, and to be fair, most people were well behaved most of the time. If you say that's okay, which I personally don't, but if you say that's okay, what's wrong with them doing it next week and stopping the next game? What's wrong with the game I'm at here tonight, people turning up, you know, Real Madrid fans and Chelsea fans, not necessarily, but any fans saying, well, we don't like what happened, so we're going to stop this game. And indeed, if you are a Newcastle fan, you're thinking, well, we don't like the way our club's run, so we're going to go and stop our game and we're going to get in. So I'm getting a bit of abuse online, which I'm a big boy and I can take, from some Man United fans saying I'm taking the corporate coin. It's rubbish. It's absolute nonsense. I'm taking no corporate coins. What I'm saying is there are consequences. And the consequences, as long as you know what they are, and if you think they are worthwhile, if this carries on like that and it means disrupting games, accept that the consequences are there. Don't blame anyone else for warning you that there are consequences. I dearly hope they get what they want. I don't think they're going to get the Glazers to walk for any less than probably $3 billion. And there's not that sort of money sloshing about just now.
No.
Do you get on the board and the say in the board? I think there's a good possibility they will. And it's partly because of what the fans have done and what the fans have said. I suspect they might have had a similar impact had they done it outside the ground, but many United fans would disagree with that, and I respect that view as well. But it's where it goes from here. I was here at Stamford Bridge just the other week there, during the Brighton game, when the whole European Super League fell apart. And I'm like, I'm cheering with the rest of them. I'm up there. I'm delighted with it. And that's kind of the way you want it to be. So, all put out of the fans' elbows, doing what they're doing, trying not lose the game, especially as people are trying to take it down the route where it's, you know, going to a competition that's not getting relegation and promotion, all that nonsense. That's just rubbish. The other side of it is a completely different thing. It's the Glazers. And how can you get your club back? And that's really difficult, because then you look into the world of reality. And reality is, can you really see them walking away on the cheap? Can you really see them giving you half ownership of the club for either cheap or nothing? It's kind of hard to say. If they get supporters on the board, and by the way, there's plenty that are intelligent enough to be there, and sit there and say to these people who don't seem to be listening and have a cloth ear about anything that's said and don't have a feeling for what football should be, never mind Manchester United, then it'd be great if you had them on. Whether they could have real impact, who knows? You know, quite often I've seen it before when fans are allowed on boards and it's a kind of sop. You know, they're let on, and then when the real business comes about, they're hoofed out, because they can't be in there for contract talks, they can't be in there for buying and selling players, because if the word gets out, it's mayhem, madness lies that way. And that's a difficulty you've got to find out which direction to go in that. But in the midst of it all, I mean, I really do hope that football is at a turning point just now. And a lot of the people are the cause of this, and I was going to say the blame, it's not the blame, they're to be celebrated for it, are the fans.
Yeah.
Getting together, doing the right things. I'm just wary of, I don't want to be champion. I know Roy Keane and Gary Neville, I think they were shouting, saying, this is great, this is what we want, or whatever. What's that effect? To be fair, when you go over the line and you stop the games and the violence and all that sort of stuff, even though it was limited this time, I'm wary of that. And I'm wary of that because of where I come from. I played in the 80s. And I know it was a different reason for violence, but we had it out of the game. And we kind of don't want anything back. Because for all the fact that the vast majority of the fans that are doing it are great and doing the right things, you've always got the idiots. You know, and you need to be careful with that.
Yeah, for sure. It was hard not to see the footage of the police officer whose cheekbone was in a bad way and the gash under his eye and not feel that that was very, very ugly and hard to get behind in any way at all, to be honest. Didn't think much of that. And yet there is the it's only a minority argument, but they'll always be there. So these fans on the board business, I mean, I'm not shocked to hear you say it's just piecemeal token stuff, and when the real decisions are being made, they're not there. Like the Glazers one is almost very specific. Like this is a residual anger. This really isn't about the European Super League. I mean, it has re-energised the debate for sure, but this is about the fact that they bought the club with the club's own money. The club were the collateral. You know, you kind of had Graeme Souness even talking on Sky saying, oh, well, look, they've put in money. It's like, well, they haven't. They've done the opposite. And they've bought the club. They've used the club as collateral. They have taken out about $1 billion. They take dividends. They pay off the interest. They pay off the loans. Yes, they spend money. They do spend money, but it's the club's money. I mean, shock horror, the richest club in the world generates money so they can buy a couple of players. I mean, it's fans' money. I mean, Man United are a special case. So, like, what's the answer there? I mean, is a fan going to sit on the board and say, we'd prefer if you stop taking out all this money? And the Glazers will say, no, we're going to keep on taking out this money. They're not going to sell it on the cheap, far from it. They mightn't sell it until it goes to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 billion. Who knows? Like Neville's idea of some kind of football regulator interests me. I think that could be an avenue. And this is the really boring stuff. Like, so, you know, get in the pitch, get the Glazers out. Ah! It's so exciting. Okay, but it's not going to happen. So some kind of legislative effort to get a hold of football, which will be slow and boring and about committees and all that kind of stuff. To me, that seems like the only viable way over the next couple of years to make genuine change.
I would move the word couple of years to something else a lot longer than
decades.
The way governments work. Yeah. Call me cynical. Governments in the UK will only do it if it suits them and if it gives them like leeway and leverage with you know, voters. That's how they think of it. So if it can be sold to the governments in such a way that, by the way, this will help you and you'll get votes and everyone's piling on behind you. Personally, I don't see a lot of Man United fans piling on behind the Tory government at the moment. So it is a tricky one. It would be really nice if it was, you know, outside government and you could do it in that way. But politics is dirty. Politics is ugly. The other thing about that, when we always fought in football, and we have for many, many years of trying to keep the politicians out of it, because any time they get involved in it, in times gone past, the ideas they come up with were bizarre, and they understood football just about as much as the Glazers. Mm. You know, that is the case. They really don't get it. What they do get is how they can pull power towards themselves. So that is something, if you could set up some sort of commission, that would be absolutely great. But a commission that was talented enough, had the strength to do it, and they would have a lot of difficult decisions to make, not all of which would be incredibly popular with a lot of other clubs. You know, there are certain clubs that would say, well, wait a minute, that might suit Man United, but it doesn't suit us. If you're Man City, it might not suit them. You might say to them, well, we want, you know, whatever, this sort of control of the club, to which owners of certain clubs might say, well, they're off then. And that club might then plummet. And, you know, the fans of that club might say, oh, thanks very much. You know, I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I know what I would like. I would like not to go back to the good old days, but stop it being a conglomerate-led world business that doesn't care about the heart and soul of the game. That's what I would like. Mm. But like you know, that's not where it is just now. And to unpick that and untie that, you say a couple of years, I mean, really, I mean, no chance, absolutely yeah. no chance. It would take a long, 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 long time for this to happen. And one of the biggest difficulties when you get into situations like this is to try and get one size fits all for everyone.
Yeah.
It doesn't always kind of work for everyone. But again, if I knew an answer, and that's the closest answer I think I can see, but that's fraught with dangers. I warn people up front, and I tell you what, I warn Man United fans up front, it might not be what you want when you actually get there with those sort of people, because the last thing you want is certain people who do, or they claim to have a love of football, and some might, but some of them might have very different ideas from you.
Mm. Well, I'm not a legal expert. You would think it's possible to generate some kind of legislation whereby for institutions which are part of the social fabric, i.e. football club, leverage buyouts should be a non-starter. Stuff like that. You know,
yeah,
when you think how vulnerable they were, these like unbelievably valuable institutions, undervalued, it turns out, you know, because the last 15 years, boom, talk about appreciation and value. It's mad how vulnerable they were left.
Yeah, I mean, I came up with some ideas a number of years ago, many years ago, to explain, look, there's something you need to do. There's one group of people in the midst of this that is the problem. And it's not what people think, right? Look at the business and follow the money, right? Why is this business model not working? Why are you getting billionaires in? Because it's a really, really, really expensive business to run. Mm. Why is it expensive to run? Where are all the costs? The costs are in one place. It's the playing staff. Now, if the players are going to earn these sorts of extraordinary sums and they're exponential and they continue to grow, like Real Madrid said, yeah, they're not my heroes, they're not like them. But they said this model doesn't work for them. It doesn't work for loads. It works if you happen to be backed by a government,
yeah.
you know, Middle Eastern government. This model's not working. So if there was some way, and it's damn hard to get to work legally, and by the way, it was hard enough when you had the UK and the European Union. Now that you've not, now after Brexit, doubly hard because you get different legal systems. If you can make it some way that there was an agreement that could have something akin to a wage cap, that's a possibility that you could start driving down the costs a bit and you could actually make the thing sensible. And it wouldn't be owned by sovereign wealth funds and it wouldn't be owned by different nations. You could actually keep it within the country or in-house or in within funds. You could do that. But the will to get that to be done, I can't see it. I just absolutely can't see it.
Because interestingly, it was part of the Super League proposal. Like that spoke of the desperation of the likes of Agnelli and Florentino Perez. They wanted a salary cap.
Yeah, and if you keep on going the way you're going just now, right, it can't work. Now, I got this wrong because I thought after 5-10 years of the Premier League, this can't work. Mm. This is bizarre. These numbers don't work because it's just exponential growth. And you keep on having to make all that much more money. And it is bizarre because you're freezing everybody out except, I mean, Google will own one club and, you know, Facebook will own another, whatever. That's the only people going to be able to afford clubs if you let it keep going to this level. Mm. Because football is a mad business. Mm. It isn't controlled in that way because you keep on fighting and you overspend and you overspend and you overspend. So people will tell you it's a simple, easy way. I mean, a simple, easy way, if say the Glazers did walk tomorrow, right, and United managed to get the club and the ownership, well, good luck trying to stay up with Man City if it's in the current methodology. No chance.
Yeah.
Absolutely no chance because of the finances. So the model has to be looked at and the model has to be changed. And it has to be changed in a bigger financial way. Now, I'm not moaning at players. If I was a player, you'd take money. If they're offering it and that's the market rate, you'd take it. But be honest, if the top wages weren't, you know, £1 million quid a week and they were £250,000 a week, they probably play for it, you know. They would probably manage it.
Yeah.
So the market's utterly skewed in that way. Now, hands up, part of the problem originally, because, you know, I was on the PFA, I was chairman. Mm. We fought for players' rights. We made sure that when the Premier League was started that we had a very, very strong position. It's just stunning how strong it's got. So it's not just one group. It's always one person that gets the flat. And to be honest, I'm kind of delighted it's the Glazers myself. Mm. But you have to be realistic. You've got to have a wider look at it. And that wider look takes in governments, takes in European law, takes on British law, takes in completely. And it's, and by the way, the minute you do it, say you want a private company, I mean, top of your head, Tottenham, whatever, right? Okay, we want you to do it the way we want you to do it. We don't care if you've invested X amount of hundreds of millions or whatever, or even Chelsea or whoever. We're taking that off you. Well, that's not going to go down with them very well.
No.
They're going to sue them, you know. And if somebody took my money off me that I'd saved all my life, I would be a bit miffed about it too. So if people do think it's circle and they want a binary answer, you'll get binary answers for some people. I won't give you a binary answer because it doesn't work like that.
No, look, it's why we have you on. It's so complicated. It really is. And the more you pick at it, the more difficult it gets.
I'm laughing because I pick up the Twitter feed and I turn it on and I get Man United fans and you're on the side of the big business and I'm thinking, you're not really listening, are you?
No.
You know, it's much more complex than that. And I'm on your team, but good on the pressure. Keep the pressure going.
Mm.
And it might well be nudging and it might well be moving in new directions. And if that power has already had an effect in the Super League, and it could have an effect. I mean, I'm beginning to hear little whispers now that some of the bigger clubs are saying, right, okay, we're going to get board representation. We're beginning to hear a bit about it now. You hadn't got a stuff of a chance before we started seeing what happened outside Stamford Bridge, outside Arsenal, and definitely outside Old Trafford, and to some degree inside Old Trafford too.
I know, but you already know how the board are going to play. I mean, as you said at the start, the board will play them easy all day long, no problem. What is interesting maybe in the more immediate term, as opposed to all that very complicated long-term stuff, which will just be so difficult to get over the line. I'm just curious to see where the Glazers thing goes, like to just bring it back to that micro situation. So the Manchester United Supporters Trust have written to all the sponsors of the club and they've called for a boycott and they've talked about how the Glazers engorge on commercial revenue and you exploit the fan base to access global markets. Fans are left desperate as the club, weighed down by debt, is unable to marshal its own resources and compete where it should be competing. Supporting the Glazers is therefore an attack on Manchester United Football Club. To that end, Manchester United fans will boycott your products, seek to tarnish your brands and support your competitors until you terminate your commercial partnership with the Glazer family. Now, if they get the 150 million United supporters worldwide to go along with this, then we're talking. I mean, then things do get interesting. Where they go remains to be seen. Boycotts of the games gets interesting as well. Because basically what happened in was it 05, the leverage buyout was? And they set up the separate club. Like, there was a bit of energy behind it. But if you remember, Ferguson pretty much gave the lads the okay and the training ground's really good and they give me everything I asked for, so I'm kind of okay with it, and his word was gospel and none of the players came out. But this is a different climate now. There might be a bit more petrol in the tank on this one.
I can hope so. I'm okay with boycotts. I've always felt that. Certainly my past and things that I felt I've not wanted and liked in life, going all the way back to South Africa, boycott, never bought a South African thing in my life. Until, you know, the apartheid system was, you know, done.
Mm.
And to be honest, sport and boycotts worked against that. So, look, you can bring it down a country or a bring down a system. Hey, this is only football. So, it's, you know, there is a possibility there. It takes a lot. I mean, it's a long, hard slog that, you know, and it's, in the end, there is only one way of getting to the Glazers. It's through the value of the company. And in a way, and it's so diametrically opposite of what Manchester United fans want, you almost have to damage the value of the company. And that's counterintuitive,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Counterintuitive to do that. And I certainly wouldn't sit there going, you've got to damage your company. It's just wild. It's a wild bit. I understand why many United fans, and certainly the most extreme United fans, would almost consider the ultras, they would absolutely be happy to do that.
Mm.
there's plenty out there that they wouldn't are really unhappy about that. There's plenty of, so there's, that's the problem. Again, Andy Mitten, I don't know if he said it in your show, but he certainly had said it a few times, but I was listening to it in various places, saying, look, we are quite a wide church. There's a lot of people that really disagreed with what we did and thought we were a disgrace to be on the pitch and doing what we did. And there is, and the openness to be able to say that, it's getting this everything together, and they've tried it quite a few times. But I think in this occasion, that's why you have to be quite clever with your protests. Make sure you keep as many people on board and don't fracture your protest.
Yeah.
It's always the biggest problem with protests. When you fracture and go in different directions, you're weakened,
yeah.
and also you lose public support. And maybe that was as much the reason why I'm thinking, not sure stopping the game was that great an idea. Did you begin to fracture them?
Yeah, I think a second game cancelled might fracture it. Come here, sorry, I've gone too long on that. You've probably a minute here. Man City are through, full-time there, 2-0 win. Who are they playing in the final?
You can't call this one. It's getting brilliant, real in for it. The midfield battle between Chelsea and Real Madrid in the first game was exceptional, the quality of players that was in there. Chelsea won it. Chelsea was superb, but Chelsea can also be a bit insipid on occasions. I think I'm looking forward to this game more than any game this season, because it could be rubbish, but it'll still be exciting. It could be mayhem. Thomas Tuchel actually won the tactical battle hands down last time. Don't know why. Zidane went for a back three, and it was an absolute and utter shambles in the first half, and he could have been out of the competition. I don't think he'll do that again. You'll see the Real Madrid in this one. And Chelsea have got everybody fit and everybody strong. This could be a cracker, honestly, complete and utter toss up. Chelsea have got a slight advantage. They've got the away goal and they've got the home advantage, but it's hardly anything. You've not got a bunch of fans in there as well. Toss the coin, complete toss the coin. I will say one thing, Man City are utter favourites to win this competition.
Yeah,
because although Chelsea beat them recently in the FA Cup, Man City, this is what Man City's all about. And slightly worryingly for Chelsea, this is what Real Madrid's all about. They know when to turn it on. Year after year after damn year, you think they're a bit rubbish. And then Champions League, they turn on one of the Champions League because they focus completely on that. And this will be their entire game. And they've been there before, so they know how to do it. Great game. Couldn't call it.
Yeah, beautifully set up. Well, listen, we'll talk about it on Monday. Pat, thanks a million.
Look forward to it.
Cheers. Pat Nevin there with us. So, as I said, Man City through to that Champions League final. Chelsea, Madrid tomorrow. We'll have Philippe Auclair previewing that game tomorrow evening. Football on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. David Myler will be on OTBAM tomorrow, looking back on tonight's game and ahead to tomorrow's. Best place to get that, the OTB Sports app in your app store. Just search it. It's there for free. We'd Brendan Driscoll this evening talking Leinster, La Rochelle. Very interesting on Leinster and their shortcomings. And also giving us his take on the Irish players he reckons will make the Lions squad. That's announced Thursday. He will be on the show as well Thursday evening to give you the full assessment of the squad when we have it. And Taoiseach Micheál Martin was in the studio this evening. We had about 45 minutes with him or so talking about sport and Ireland sports policy and all that kind of stuff. So it's waiting for you. Some interesting bits and pieces in it, I think. As well as Philippe, tomorrow we have Wednesday Night Rugby and Dan McDonald. Richie is in for Tom Dunk. Look.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein powered chicken bites.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.